LinkedIn News.
From the news team at LinkedIn, I'm Jesse Hempel, and this is Hello Monday. It's our show about the changing nature of work and how it's changing us. And yes, you can still hear that cold I have. I really hope that by next week, it'll be gone. Anyhow, bear with me, because here we go. As a commander in the U.S. Navy, Eric Potterat spent 10 years as head psychologist for the U.S. Navy SEALs. Now, I know you have probably heard of the Navy SEALs, but if they're new to you, here's what they're about. They are the most elite members of our armed forces. People who work in small groups to carry out the most high-stakes operations our military conducts. When the United States finally took down Osama bin Laden, well, that was a SEALs team. The SEALs are fit, both physically and mentally. They must perform, without fail, in very high-pressure situations every time. Eric's job was to help them train mentally and to support them through their hardest moments. After he retired from the military, Eric brought that same know-how to his next job, as a psychologist for the Los Angeles Dodgers. Now, these athletes were working in stressful environments, too. The stakes were high, albeit very different. And that was this big aha for Eric.
I just had this epiphany. Regardless of the disciplines that these elite men and women were portraying in their lives, it started to stick out to me. These men and women are generally doing the same things.
So what things are top performers doing? And how can the rest of us follow in their footsteps? We'll get into all of that and more after the break.
The LinkedIn Podcast Network is sponsored by Alumni Ventures. Invest with confidence. Discover the power of venture investing with Alumni Ventures, America's largest venture firm for individual investors. Learn more at av.vc.
We all perform every day in every role that we play. In my case, mother, journalist, interviewer, corporate warrior of a type. We're always trying to raise the bar, and exceptional performance isn't merely the domain of Navy SEALs and pro baseball players. In fact, that's why Eric Potterat had the occasion to meet Alan Eagle, the Google executive who became his collaborator. Eric was speaking at Google. It was 2020, and Alan was working from home. Alan put the talk on a Zoom screen while he ate his lunch, and by the end of the hour, he was inspired by this one big idea.
As Eric likes to put it, you know, their way to learn excellence is above the neck and between the ears.
Alan got in touch with Eric, and together they began to interview high performers of every type. They wrote a book together called Learned Excellence, Mental Discipline for Leading and Winning from the World's Top Performers. Today I've invited Eric and Alan to share what they have learned with us. What follows is a playbook for how to become better at whatever is important to you. Eric starts by explaining that improving our own performance, well, it begins with training ourselves to care less about what other people think.
I think what's happening is, you know, as we age and stage in life, most humans, we become a little less engaged and we care less in general about what other people think. So as we become wiser rather than older, I think most of us get more comfortable in our skin. Like, I just don't really care what people think. But what I noticed early on, about midway through my career in dealing with these top performers, is they just are seeming to accelerate that natural movement anyhow. Yeah. From really valuing reputation. Instead, they're doubling down on identity. So we tried to actualize a way or a process for, you know, the individual reader to think about how they can accelerate that process as well. So.
Yeah, we talk about identity, not reputation. And one of the big ahas for me as we were working on this was, I know who I am, but do I really? Like, you sort of know who you are, but do you really take the time to write it down, to really codify that and define the values, your identity markers? No, you don't. You know, you talked about how the best performers accelerate this process and they do know who they are and why they're competing and why they're performing. I think for the rest of us, it would behoove everybody, you know, when earlier in your career, write down your value credo. We go through a process in the book of how you do that. That really defines who you are. What do you care about? And then whenever you come to a major decision, whenever you're going through a major performance, go back to that value credo, understand it, memorize it. And that really helps you get better.
Let's talk about that value credo a second. You know, if I were to ask you, Eric, do you know what your value credo is off the top of your head?
I do.
Oh, Eric knows this one cold for sure.
One of my key words is wonder. So my entire credo would be wonder, stay humble, stay hungry, stay connected, love, laugh, listen. And I just, that's who I am at my core. I always want to have a sense of wonder or curiosity. I want to stay connected to people. I don't want to be complacent. Humility is super important to me. And then I hopefully want to listen more than I speak. Obviously, in my profession, that should happen anyhow. And then I want to have a sense of humor as well. So I don't want to talk about myself in the third person, but the older Eric was definitely consumed by, like most of us, I want to be a good performance psychologist. I want to be a clinical psychologist. But I think, you know, the newer me, the evolved me really came to understand that, hey, these elite performers are just accelerating this. I can start making decisions through that, vector them through my filter of what's important to me. I'm not going to be seduced by doing something for some other reason. I'm going to make sure that the decisions I make are staying true to who I am and what I value.
Alan, do you similarly have the immediate sense of what your credo is off the top of your head?
I have not memorized it, but you know, there's integrity, self-awareness, nature, adventure, family, friends, humor, and health. I think I've got fun in there as well.
Well, it's interesting. It feels like at first, you know, I thought about the credo as a way that we figure out what we want to do more of. But actually, I think for me personally, it would be a more useful tool to figure out what to say no to and how to say the no in a way that it is heard and respected and essentially furthers my reputation most likely because it's an integrity, right?
Exactly. One of the guys we talked to was David Colturi, who's a Red Bull cliff diver. Mm-hmm. And David talked about kind of an epiphany he had. He had a bad accident. He was unable to compete for a while. And during that time, he started to work with Eric and developed his values credo. And one of the things he said was it helped him say no to things.
Right.
Like, I don't want to go to that party. I don't care what people are going to think if they see me there or not, or you know, whatever the event is. So yeah, it becomes very powerful in that regard.
Eric, when you were working with David, you talked about creating an accountability plan and the importance of writing it down. My gut says, of course, it's important, but articulate it for us. Why is it important to actually write it down?
So there are interesting statistics around putting things in writing and setting goals, et cetera. And one of the things I would offer you and the audience to think about is we know a mountain of things about just goal setting in general. If we ideate a goal, so if we just come up and think about a goal, statistically speaking, if we set goals, just think about goals, we achieve those goals about 34% of the time, which isn't bad. If we then put, you know, those goals to writing, whether it's old school pen to paper or new school Excel spreadsheet, et cetera, those statistics go up to about 62%. The profound change for me, the aha, if you will, was the goal setting research that if we actually share the goal verbally with an accountability partner in addition to writing it down. So think teammate, significant other, coworker, friend, that statistic goes up to about 76%. So we can all make ourselves more self-accountable, I think, by, you know, not only ideating a goal, but putting it in writing and then verbally sharing it, right? The cat's out of the bag. If I tell Jesse my goal, I'm a little bit more motivated to achieve that goal for social reasons, right? Peer pressure.
I wonder if you both might, and either of you can take this first, talk to me about mindset and how we should think about mindset.
Yeah, well, I'll jump in and then hand it off to Eric. There's a couple of ahas for me as we went through the process of writing the book. And the first one is simply that you can choose your mindset. I think most people, you know, we wake up and there's my mindset. This is what I was born with or what I was raised with. This is my default and I'm just going to go with it. And maybe I'll work on some improvement around the edges, but I don't need to change it. Well, that's not true. You can define the mindset you want. And then the other aha is that for different roles, you need different mindsets. I'm a husband, I'm an author, I'm a parent, I'm a son. Each of those requires a different mindset. And again, what we usually do not do is think about that mindset in each role and define what it ought to be. And then the other key thing is, how do you actually practice it? Well, we talk about you practice mindset through the controllables. The controllables are attitude, effort, and behavior. Eric calls it staying in the circle. And all of these things are, you know, mindset's become a very popular term in the last 20, 25 years. And yet, did you realize you can define it? You should have a different mindset for different roles, and you can actually practice it?
I think, Jesse, for me, I think with respect to mindset, there are three main takeaways that, you know, I learned from these thousands of top performers. They tend to be more growth mindsetted. That's number one. And there's obviously Carol Dweck's work is spot on. And really the hallmark symptom, if you will, for having a growth mindset would be, am I thirsty for useful feedback in victory and defeat? You know, how much do I want feedback and how much do I want to continue to move outside of my comfort zone? So growth mindset is number one. Number two, with respect to these elite performers, which is still, again, learnable, none of us are born with this, is really a challenge mindset versus a threat mindset. So when we're all presented with adversities, which are continuing to come, and that's, you know, we could speak for days on that, you know, do we approach that with, hey, this is nothing more than a unique challenge as opposed to a threat to my identity, my reputation, my ego, my bottom line if you're a business, et cetera, my fans, whatever it may be if you're an athlete. And then lastly, and I would make the strong argument with what Alan said, I'll double down on this significantly, is the different mindsets for every role that we play. You know, if you can just simply, a tactic would be to think of the three main words that you think you need to optimally perform within that role mindset-wise, and just use that as a mantra, it helps transition. So if I'm a professional athlete, for example, or I'm a very competitive worker, maybe competitive, gritty, relentless is my mindset at work. Mm-hmm. But then when I go to, you know, at home to my wife or my kids, I'm changing my keywords, almost like that dimmer switch. I'm dimming to a different mindset, focusing on, you know, patience and empathy, et cetera.
We're going to take a quick break here. If you like this conversation, be sure to sign up for our weekly newsletter at linkedin.com/HelloMonday. We'll drop career advice and episode highlights directly into your inbox every Monday. More with Eric Potterat and Alan Eagle when we return. And we're back. I was really struck by the three controllable aspects that Eric and Alan mentioned earlier in our conversation. You know the ones: attitude, effort, and behavior. I wanted to know if top performers of any field figured this out for themselves early, or if they were kind of born that way, or if there's a longer learning process to get to this realization. Eric has thoughts.
I'm not sure I have an absolute convicted response here, other than if I'm probably going to be 85 to 90% on the side of the fence that they've learned them. And again, I think one needs to be very careful, because sometimes the top performers sometimes have egos and they want to think at some level, I was born this way. When in fact, when you do that kind of psychological autopsy, as it were, and you unpack this, they've had really good teachers, mentors, parents, kind of that village approach, right? So they've had these key influencers. And they've also navigated, as Alan said, I think very accurately, kind of micro failures, sometimes macro failures, but they've learned through, okay, I fall down, I fail with a small F, and then I have an ecosystem around me that is going to teach me tools, techniques, disciplines to learn from that and practice. So
yeah.
I'm a big believer, Jesse, that I think people navigate, they evolve this, kind of they iterate,
right,
over time. It just isn't a one size fits all. I come out of the womb and I'm ready to perform. It's nonsense. So
Eric brought up this idea of failure. And I always want to roll my eyes a little bit when I'm talking to people in technology about failure. because I have lived through many years of being a tech reporter and listening to entrepreneurs tell me that failure is the most important thing and they want to fail. And then you ask them, tell me about your failure. And they're like, oh, I don't want to talk about that. The truth is, like, failure hurts. It doesn't hurt less over time. It hurts consistently. Maybe, though, we get better at allowing for the hurt.
Maybe. I think my perspective on failure perhaps is a little bit different. Obviously, I'm not in technology, but coming from a military and then sport background, I can tell you that, you know, there's some quotes that kind of come to mind. I either win or I learn. And I think at the end of the day, when you look at these macro or micro failures, they're a win as long as people can tell you what they learned from them. The people I fear in the world are the ones that fail and make no effort to either have introspection, navigate their ecosystem of feedback, those mentors, their coaches, friends, et cetera, where they can actually learn and iterate from those. So maybe the truth is somewhere in between. I think, you know, I'm not going to lie and say failures aren't painful. That's absurd. But I think if we can pivot and kind of reframe that as, okay, what did I take away from that? That's learning.
Yeah.
And one of the things I think all, you know, the three of us on this conversation today would agree, if we did an honest appraisal of our lives, I almost guarantee that all of us will look at our failure moments as the times we've learned the most.
And you're also, you're talking about failures with a capital F, you know, the big failures, the entrepreneur whose company fails. And I've worked, before I went to Google, I was at five different startups over my career in Silicon Valley, and three of them were failures. So I've been through the big failures. But I'm, you know, also think about more about how do you handle, let's call them setbacks. Okay. You're a single person and you go on a date, it doesn't go well. That's not a failure. That's just a setback. Well, how do you handle it? What's your attitude? What's your effort? Are you going to go, you know, hide on your couch for the next month, or are you going to get back out there? So these are the sort of things that, you know, the smaller adversities build your practice, build your exercise, and how to handle the bigger ones.
This building processes piece, it's super important. Eric tells this story about a soldier he knew who accidentally shot himself in the leg during a training mission. Why? He'd done things differently than he normally did. He put his holster on a different leg, and at a critical moment, that threw off his entire game. Now, that soldier suffered a minor injury, but it highlighted a major issue.
Well, one of my roles within the as a psychologist for the SEAL teams were to accompany them, and we would use and we would leverage technology to help SEALs in live fire, kind of a labyrinth as they go through training for, let's say, hostage rescue and breaching, et cetera. Well, we would teach them breathing techniques, and we would have heart rate variability monitors on them, and I would have an iPad, and I would be on top of the catwalk, and we would kind of see how their breathing rates are correlating with marksmanship, et cetera. In a separate labyrinth in these houses that they you know, learn to do tactics, there was a foreign special operations team. We'll leave the country out of it, but there was a situation where, you know, you heard live fire and then some screaming, some angry screaming. And lo and behold, there was a foreign special operator from a non-US country. And he had shot himself in the leg. Luckily, it kind of just followed the fascia down. It had an entry wound and an exit wound just right above the knee. And he was furious because he was obviously going to be grounded, right, to say the least, and probably have to go through all sorts of remediation. But as they unpacked that with their foreign medic, it became evident that it was the first time that he had used a brand new holster for his weapon. And I use this as a very visceral example of, you know, many of us are doing jobs where we require technology, maybe given a PowerPoint, using a new app, new ski boots. If you're a skier, you know, you can think about tons of different examples of this, but it was a very visceral example that, you know, you need to be very clear in your process and practice that process over. And anytime you iterate something new or incorporate something new, boy, oh boy, there can be significant consequences,
yeah,
whether it's a failed PowerPoint in front of 1500 people or whether it's literally shooting yourself in the leg. So,
yeah. Yeah. And actually, you mentioned failed PowerPoint. That's right where my mind jumped as I thought of that. The number of things that we actually can do ourselves the service of preparing for in advance well through process. You also talk in that section about the importance of time management and this idea that one thing that seems to separate people from who are extraordinarily successful from others is that they truly own the time that they have in a day, right?
Absolutely. I honestly, this was my biggest epiphany, to be very, very frank, when I was dealing with these top performers is, look, I think Alan and I write that we all manage the same 24 hours in a day, right? Until some advanced researcher or physicist somewhere can kind of warp time and give us more or less. Generally speaking, I think every performer, irrespective of what you do, you're managing the same time. When you unpack that further, the top performers are just leveraging, they're owning their time markedly differently. And there's a volitional piece here. They're not just, we talk about white space and calendars. This can be controversial because people are going to think you're overtasking them with, hey, do I need to eliminate all my white space? Am I creating more busy work? And in fact, all we're recommending is do as these top performers are doing and fence those things as non-negotiables. We all have the same 24 hours. How do you spend it?
The core message that Eric repeats all the time is process, not outcome. Professionals focus on process, amateurs on outcome. And time management is a core part of anybody's process. How do you allocate your time and invest that time wisely?
I thought about that a little bit with regard to what has become my New Year's resolution. I'm not a big resolutions person, but I did begin the new year with the personal commitment to myself that I'm going to read every day for 45 minutes. Just a paper book read, because I find that every aspect of my intellectual and emotional life grows when I have that practice in place. I always try to read a lot. I love to read. That's not hard for me. But I didn't make dedicated time for it because, of course, it would just fill the rest of the time that I had. Anything else that I was doing, like, it would be followed up by reading. And I realized as the year ended last year and I have two very small children at home and a new puppy and a busy job, I was writing a book, I just had stopped reading because I hadn't assigned the time to it. And that's the sort of practice you're talking about there. Right.
And how do you put it in your calendar? How do you block out? How do you make sure you do it?
I do it every morning from 5:30 to 6:15. We are 9 days into the year and I haven't missed a day yet. And also for me, that's not hard time. It's my favorite time of the day. It is not hard for me to be up then. It is not hard for me to have my own time then. So it's, you know, I've given it the best time that I have in a day. Everything else can follow.
That's going to go hand in hand with the thing that you talked about before, which is really practicing saying no. Or what I like to say is not now to people, because sometimes saying no frustrates people. And so I think that as you fence that time, it sounds like you're doing it beautifully. That becomes a non-negotiable.
Before I let you both go, I want to talk a little bit about the importance of balance. There's this one example of a woman, Dina Ryerson, who is a senior AG in Oregon. You know, she believed that you can't have it all as a woman. And Eric, your message to her was, well, actually you can. And I'm just going to say, I kind of need to hear it. Will you unpack that a little bit?
Yeah, I think it comes down, not to sound too cliche, but ages and stages. I think that one of the metaphors that I like to use is kind of a beach house on pillars, right? Imagine all of us are a beach house on pick your favorite beach and we're on pillars. Some people are going to be on one or two pillars. Some people are going to be on five or six. Well, as to continue that metaphor, as the waves of adversity come in, as that happens, you're going to have obviously the home on one or two pillars become less stable versus five or six. So when you talk about balance in general, it used to be fairly controversial that it used to be thought, you know, the top performers cannot be balanced because they're going to sacrifice at their performance at whatever they do. In fact, the research, the meta-analyses are markedly different. And when you take a look at these individuals who are very well balanced, and we'll come back to ages and stages in a moment, they're more innovative, they live longer, and by the way, they're more productive. Now, with respect to Dina, great example. There are ages and stages that we all go through in life. You're a great example as well. You have young children. So you may have to drop certain balls, but it doesn't mean that you can't catch up and feed and water other pillars at other times. The thing that I worry about is the individuals who spend way too much time becoming what they do at the expense of relationships, parenting, health. They have this legacy job with maybe a mountain of money at the end, but they've been through 18 divorces. They need liver transplants because of substance use, et cetera. I mean, I'm exaggerating here, but I think at the end of the day, one has to be okay with dropping certain balls or not feeding and watering certain pillars, knowing that this is an age and stage.
Yeah, and our conversation with Dina was pretty nuanced along those lines. When she was in the middle of a trial, for example, she really dropped all the other balls. And the point is to be okay with that. It's okay. Sometimes you have to focus on just one thing, but to be aware that you are undernourishing the other pillars of your life.
Sort of brings us full circle, honestly, to the beginning of our conversation, where we, you know, dug into this idea that as we age, we learn to think less of what other people think of us and more of what we think of ourselves, right? We make our own choices.
You know, people think of work-life balance of, it's a 50-50 thing. There's a formula. And what we're saying is actually there's multiple pillars in your life. There's work, there's relationships, there's your hobbies, there's your health, there's your spirituality, there's your legacy. Be aware of whatever is the best balance for you. Just, you know, make sure it's not zero across three of those. And you're right. Be aware of what's best for you.
That was Eric Potterat and Alan Eagle. Their new book is called Learned Excellence, Mental Discipline for Leading and Winning from the World's Top Performers. You can find it wherever books are sold. Over the last few episodes, I've felt this theme emerging. Our guests have anchored their advice in a shared understanding of their values. Today's conversation added some great thoughts to this theme, and here are just a few that I'm taking with me. First, I love this values credo. Susie Welch spoke last week about the importance of learning what we value and living by that. Eric and Alan encourage us to distill our values into a sort of mantra. Then we can use that mantra to set limits in our lives. They can help us say yes to the things that help with our life goals and no to everything else. Second, Alan and Eric make a strong case for having a different mindset for different areas of our lives and consciously moving between them. We can use keywords to help us do this. Like my work keywords might be clarity, purpose, and understanding. And my keywords to switch my mindset when I get home might be clarity, always clarity, compassion, and empathy. I have small kids, folks. Finally, Eric and Alan teach us this handy catchphrase. Professionals focus on process, amateurs focus on outcome. How we manage our time is all about process. We can each commit to making the most of our time. And now we welcome Scott Olster, our big ideas editor, our books editor. Scott, it is great to have you in the studio for a book segment. It is my favorite segment that we do on Hello Monday. And that's not just because, Scott, it's actually the only segment that we host on Hello Monday, the book segment. We originated it in 2023. We tried a few things, but book segment was what stuck. And really, it stuck because you. We love having you on the show, Scott.
Oh, thank you so much, Jesse. I love being here, too.
So what have you been reading lately?
So one of the books that I've been reading is a bit personal, and it's actually not a new book. It's a book that I chose because of where I am right now in my particular moment of life, and it's called The Five Invitations. And it's by a Buddhist teacher named Frank Ostaseski. Mm-hmm. And Frank actually co-founded an organization called the Zen Hospice Project. And it was groundbreaking when it first opened in the late 1980s, just because Frank and his co-founders, they took a very novel, compassionate approach to people who are at the end of their lives. So it's a heavy choice. But as you know, Jesse, I lost my father in October, and I wanted to go on a bit of a quest with this reading to figure out what is the process of dealing with loss, both for the person who's the one in the process of dying, and also their families. So yeah, definitely a personal one.
Scott, I am so sorry about the loss of your father. And I have to say that I appreciate that you have spoken about it so openly here with all of us, your colleagues and friends. I think so many of us have had this experience of loss, and yet when you are experiencing it, it feels so personal, sometimes isolating and lonely. And reading is also what I would reach for in my moments. And I'm curious what this book gave you.
Yeah, of course. And for me, Frank Ostasevsky and the approach that he has taken in all of his work has been to try your best to lean into the pain, to not avoid it, to not try to hide it, to not try to power through it in like sort of a very forced way, but to basically start the acceptance process and to be curious about what's going on around you, whether this is a loss that you yourself are experiencing or one that you are witnessing, and be present as much as possible. And that's really what the Five Invitations is all about. It's about really embracing and being present for all the things that may seem difficult, just because his argument and the argument of a lot of his teachers has been that the pushing away, the avoidance, it actually is the thing that creates the suffering.
Yeah. So Scott, leave us with one tiny detail about this book.
So the book, you know, at its surface is about death and dying, but actually it's all about living life well. These are lessons for life, not for death. Mm. So that's number one. But the one other thing that I did pick up that really stuck with me are the kinds of things that people truly think about when they are in the process of passing away. And the two key questions that he says come up the most are, am I loved? And did I love well? And I think he's really onto something. Those are the things that matter most.
Yeah. So Scott, leave us with one thing you loved about your father.
My father was a really silly man. He didn't take himself too seriously, and he was always willing to make something hard seem very light, and I'll always love that about him.
I love that idea. Thank you for being with us, Scott. We will look forward to the next book.
That was my pleasure. Thank you, Jesse.
I hope you'll join us this week for Office Hours. We'll talk about how we parlay our values into excellence. Come share your perspectives with us this Wednesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll go live from the LinkedIn news page. If you have trouble finding us, email us at hellomonday@linkedin.com and we'll send you a link. And if you can't make it, you can always find us in the Hello Monday group on LinkedIn. Hello Monday is a production of LinkedIn News. Sarah Storm produces our show with help from Lolia Briggs. Asaf Gaudron is our sound designer and engineer. Our theme music was composed just for us by the mysterious Breakmaster Cylinder. Our 24 hours in a day would be much less useful without help from our contributor, Michaela Greer. Enrique Montalvo is our executive producer. Dave Pond is head of news production. Courtney Coop is head of original programming. Dan Roth is the editor-in-chief of LinkedIn. I'm Jesse Hempel. We'll be back next Monday. Thanks for listening.
So, Jesse, are you still reading?
No, of course not. That was January. It's March, Sarah. That lasted maybe 18 days, maybe.